Something happened on the day he died. Spirit rose a meter and stepped aside. Somebody else took his place and bravely cried.
Hi, and welcome back to the third and final instalment of our chat with Donny McCaslin and Leah Kardos, in which we address the last third of the phenomenal Black Star album. Before we get going, I just want to thank you all for your feedback and comments about the first two parts of the podcast. So many of you have been in touch to say how much you've enjoyed hearing Donny share his memories, and I'm really grateful for these reactions, and I totally agree. It was an absolute pleasure and privilege to have Donny and Leah with me on these chats. So I really do hope that if you did enjoy, you might share and review this podcast. I'd really appreciate that a lot. So anyway, in this part of our discussion, we take it from Sue, or In a Season of Crime, which in many ways was the kickstart to the collaboration between Donny and his band and David Bowie. As you know, this chat was all recorded via Zoom, and as such, there are a few occasional slight glitches here and there, and I've had to re-record one or two of my questions because of technical mess-ups, but you know, that's how it goes, isn't it? But I hope that won't spoil your listening enjoyment too much, because in these conversations, Donny really does go right to the heart of the sessions, and he recalls his unique vantage point by Bowie's side as Bowie pieced together these songs, these extraordinary songs, and reflects on what would, of course, be amongst Bowie's final studio sessions, sessions which rounded off decades of, you know, innovation, excitement, hard slog and inspiration. It's just so exciting to hear from Donny what it was like to be next to Bowie at that time. So anyway, I'll stop yakking on. Let's boogie. Okay, here we go.
Last time, because this is the one where Maria Schneider really got you involved and, you know, felt that Bowie would really get a big kick out of playing with you. Now, tell me if this is true, because I, again, watching that documentary, Maria says in the documentary she introduced Bowie to you because she felt you were moving towards rock and Bowie was moving towards jazz, and she thought the intersection would be interesting.
Yeah, I think she played him. Well, he was trying to describe the rhythmic underpinning he was hearing for Sue when they were working together. And it reminded her somehow of me. And so she got out a record of mine called Casting for Gravity and played it for him. And then I think then recommended that he do something with me. I think she mentioned that to him on a few times. You know, Sue was actually, because there, you know, the version that we did with her group was so sort of definitive. This was one, you know, I talked about how a lot of these were first takes. Sue wasn't that, because I think my idea was that we should really go for something really stripped down and really drum and bassy, like David, Tim and Mark, you know, and that Jason and I kind of color around that. But because the other version is so orchestral and so, you know, thick. Mm. So we tried a couple different things with the song form, where we were essentially jamming on the first chord and David was singing, and now we cue the next chord. You know, we tried a few variations of that, and it just wasn't totally locking in. We came back to it another day, and I went back to the Maria version and essentially mapped out that as the general song form that we would follow as the band. And then I took, you know, I got the score from her, and I extracted, if that's the right word, I just kind of did a condensed version with clarinets and flutes of some of the key lines. So the key point is that we went back kind of to that song form, and I was just playing saxophone and Jason on keys, and it just felt great. And this was one where we got to a certain point in the form, and it just went kind of free. And there's the cue for that, if y'all listen again, is where David starts to sing Sue, like in another key. And you hear the rhythm section just kind of bend with him. Like, I'm remembering it and I'm getting goosebumps. You probably can't see all the way here, but it was just so, you know, cause we were in it that we, once we said, okay, we're going to do this form, it kind of locked in, you know, we're playing around, and then they got to that thing and Tim and Mark are just killing on this. And David goes, he modulates. That was totally in the moment. Like, you just heard this thing. He sings in another key and those guys just bend. Tim starts, I mean, it was total mayhem. And I was just freaking out. I was like, this is so killing, you know? And I was playing like I was going crazy, and they took a lot of it out, which is good. Cause I think that, you know, the final version does feel to me like very drum and bassy with David. And I think that's why makes it such a nice, and it's such a nice counterpoint to the other version, because it's different, but it has like the same form. And then the woodwind stuff I did was like extracted from the Maria version. So that's there, but it's not super loud. It's not in your face. It's like a hint of it, or a hint of whatever.
It's kind of like a coloring, isn't it? The woodwind.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. And that's, part of that is just, to me, what's so deep about David is that he had the courage in that moment to just go for that thing totally out of key, and the trust. And then, you know, the guys just went, and it was like, it was so exciting and just, it was like magical. And I think I said this a couple minutes ago, but like, those are the moments that you live for in a way as a musician. And in our case, you know, like, we're improvising musicians, so it's a lot of improvising, but it's that kind of magic that I think is so, that's the payoff, you know, for all those hours, all the struggle and stuff. And then you have a moment like that where somebody does something so provocative, courageous, provocative. And then the band is able to just go with it. And it's like, oh, yeah. So, I mean, I know I'm kind of getting worked up about it, but man, that says a lot about David, I have to say. I mean, the courage to do that while we're tracking and just to go for that note and let it hang out there. Man, you know, and before we leave this tune, and I also wanted to just mention, speaking of him, and a very powerful thing, you know, when we did the version with Maria, and I don't think we talked about this last time, but, you know, we recorded, we're in the studio, it's Maria's big band, it's like 8 hours, you know, of getting, you know, the whole song, and then we do edits, and it's all put together, and then before I soloed on it, they said, okay, David, let's do a scratch vocal. All right, David's been sitting in the booth for like 8 hours with Tony and others. So David comes out, a little chair, microphone set up, headphones, you know, can you hear? Like, no vocal warm-up that I can remember. I mean, you know, speaking a little bit, can you hear me? Couple notes, right? And then he does Sue, start to finish.
In one pass.
In one pass, man.
There's long notes, and then, just and a lung full of air and go. Crazy.
Man, and I think he might have then maybe he just like fixed one little spot, but it was I mean, to me, Sue's like a vocal tour de force, and then he could do that after just sitting there all day, and then according, I wasn't there, of course, when they're mixing it, but I think that's the final vocal that you hear on that version is from that day. I mean, Tony Visconti is the person to ask that question to, but my understanding is that it's basically that vocal, and that's stunning.
That is remarkable.
Remarkable, but it was a precursor to what was happening when we did Black Star, because, I think maybe we haven't talked about this yet, but you know, often the dynamic was we get the take, we decide on the take, Tim and Mark do whatever fixes they're going to do, drums and bass, of course, first, and then usually David would go in and add some harmony, re-sing this, re-sing that, but always really quick. Always really quick. Never, you know, tra-la-la, tra-la, you know, not these long, I can't hear, you know, what do you think? Like, because, you know, and again, that's the magic of his relationship with Tony. Tony was right on top of it and telling Kevin Killen, that, you know, engineer, okay, give him this. And it was so seamless. But David was, again, just to his focus and his ears. Like, he's hearing what he wants to do. He's laying it down right away. It's very efficient. I don't know. You know, the musician side of me, I just have a lot of respect for that. It was really impressive. And it, you know, the precursor was seeing what happened in Sue. And then just to see how it played out, that same dynamic kept playing itself out as we were working together.
That is absolutely breathtaking. Just the idea that he could come out of the booth, sit down and do this vocal. And this isn't just any ordinary vocal. His phrasing, the elongating, the way he's keeping it together within this framework, but just being so expressive is extraordinary.
And like an actor as well, like a character. Yeah. You know, it's not David singing about what he feels like. It's this whole construction, this story, this thing that he's acting
out. That's the thing. Yeah, that's the thing I really love about this track is it is a film noir, isn't it? It's very sinister, dark thing. You can imagine it's a story of some psychopath.
Well, I think the character is a psychopath. I think that the character is a psychopath, I mean, he kills his wife and he puts her in a, you know, it's pretty dark.
let's just be clear here, right? Unreliable narrator. Don't know exactly. With this one, when I listened to the Maria version, and I saw her orchestra, and you were there as one of the soloists at Cadogan Hall in London a few months before Black Star Stuff came out. And so I remember sort of watching the band and going, wow, the boy's working with these guys. What the heck's going on, you know? And when I heard Sue, you're like all over it. You're like playing. It's a long song as well. And you're like sort of there the whole time.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Alongside duet, like tandem, you know, parallel lines.
Yeah. It was a big surprise, Leah, when I heard the final version, because I think initially they had thought it would be like a trombone solo mostly, and Ryan Keberle was playing, but I just kind of, you know, worked on the whole thing I guess after David did that vocal, you know, he goes back in the booth and I had a gig to go to or something. So I went first, and I think, or maybe Ryan, I can't remember, but I did a few passes over the whole tune, just thinking that they would grab, you know, something here, something there. I just assumed it would be minimal. And so then, you know, 3 months later, when I heard it, I was like, whoa, that's me all over the place. Yeah. I was surprised, but I was really happy with how it sounded. I thought, I remember it felt really good playing it. And I had worked really hard on getting my head around the tune and trying to just find those spots that felt supportive to what he was doing. And not too much, you know, not too many notes or whatever, but just trying to be like a color, to complement, you know, his vocal. So,
well, I think it's such a tribute to you and your band, the fact that he felt able to let rip and to let himself really go for it. You know? I mean, I think that's just such a wonderful combination of talents here.
Thanks. It's just a heavy moment to me on that record when he goes there and the guys all go, and it just feels like that's some real magic. Just beautiful.
It's a trusting environment. Like, you know, any kind of more anxious musician might say, no, you've gone off plan, or no, that's not in the score, or that's not, no, that doesn't sound right. And put a stop. You've got this environment of trust, and especially the long relationship between Tony and David, this kind of thing of like, let's let it happen. Let's let the magic happen. And I think, you know, those defining moments that really elevate their music and make it, you know, not just a great song, but like a really amazing moment. Sometimes those accidents that, you know, everyone in the room is just like, yes, you know, everyone's saying yes, everyone's open. This is wonderful to listen to. I mean, it's a privilege actually to listen to it.
Well, we move on now to Girl Loves Me. And Girl Loves Me is the track which very famously features a lyric which is on first perusal pretty much gobbledygook. And then you realise it's inspired by Anthony Burgess's Nadsat language, as well as a smattering of Polari. And again, it's one of those tracks where Bowie's maybe got half an eye looking backwards at parts of his youth. He was a big fan of A Clockwork Orange. It was a huge influence, I think, on certain parts of his aesthetic in the early 70s. And here it is. It's popping up here on Black Star on his last album. And it's quite an interesting musical structure here. And Donny, I wanted to begin talking about this one by asking you about James Murphy, because
he
was present.
He was.
And I believe this was the track that he had actually most interaction with.
Yeah. James had brought some of his synth, you know, his vintage synth gear with him. And this track in particular, you know, there's a bit where things kind of, the cloud kind of separates and you hear, you know, him doing stuff. And he was, James was great, you know, and was really, he was there for one of the 3 weeks, and it was the week that we recorded this tune. And yeah, I mean, he's just, you know, he's a guy who looks at music from a very unique viewpoint. The sonic thing is so important to him, from what I can tell. And the sounds that he can elicit from these synths is very, you know, it's very deep in his DNA. It feels like, you know, he's put a lot of thought, a lot of effort into that language. And it's beautiful on this track, I think.
Leah, what's your take on Girl Loves Me?
It took me a while to warm to this one. It feels separated from the others in a way. And I think, yeah, I think as well, it's just a little bit impenetrable to begin with. But on the other side of the coin, it has that very accessible, very strange groove that kind of feels quite modern, even now, you know, even though it's, you know, 4 years ago when it came out. And so, yeah, I think I didn't warm to it to begin with because it didn't feel like it was the band. It felt like a production a little bit more than a band piece. But it grows on me. You know, the more I listen to it, the more I hear inside of it, because it's all quite intricate the way that it's constructed. And I think that deserves some close listening to hear exactly what's going on there.
I actually agree with you entirely, because it's even now, I couldn't say this was my favorite track on the album. And it's one that I have probably the least emotional connection with. It's intriguing lyrically, and you know, the Nadsat, on the one hand it's intriguing, on the other hand it seems such a peculiar choice. I mean, Bowie wasn't one for looking back, but this was very much of a time and place, wasn't it? You know, this was very much in vogue in the early 70s, so it was a very strange choice, in my opinion, for him to kind of zoom in on.
I don't know.
You know, a couple things.
I'm just talking rubbish. I was just going to say, like, you know, I was thinking it might have been like...
I'm talking rubbish,
not
you.
Job. I was thinking, you know, was it a bucket list thing? Like, you know, was he just always wanted to do that? You know, because he had like made up languages in the past. I'm thinking of the bizarre stuff he did, in the Berlin languagey things that he did. And maybe he just thought, I'd always wanted to do that, and so I'm doing that. I don't know. I don't want to... Because you're right. It's like, well, why?
What's on my bucket list?
You're like, I might as well. I've got my jazz album happening. That's tick. I've got my musical happening. That's tick. You know, yeah, I'm going to do that.
I'm going to do it all now. I'm going to do the.
I'm going to take up breakdancing. Okay, I'm going to, you know, learn Spanish. I don't know.
I found somebody who is dedicated enough to have translated the lyrics from that mishmash of Nadsat and Polari into English. So it sounds a bit Google Translate, but this is what this bloke has done for the second verse. You look at the woman, wonderful with a red mouth, making love, face obsessed. Young woman, watch her testicles, to sleep at the cop shop, split an old man from his money. Look at the woman.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. You know, one thing about this song, one thing I remember we were talking about, he mentioned the Clockwork Orange language in the studio, you know, and then I think we were talking, it was around the idea of spoken word and rap. And I think, you know, I think he might've been, you know, looking for a spoken word thing that felt authentic to him.
Makes sense.
You know, and I, you know, because, you know, instead of, you know, taking modern hip hop language, which wouldn't feel that, probably, I'm just assuming, maybe wouldn't feel that authentic to him, although I know he was a fan, but it's like looking for this older language or this older, you know, this older slang.
Actually, you say that.
And drawing from it. And we had that conversation. And I can't remember 100%. Was it this tune? But I'm pretty sure it was, because this is the one that matches, you know, where he's drawing from that. And I feel like that was the thinking behind it, was drawing from slang that felt, I'm saying authentic. I don't know if that's the right word to use here, but
did you sort of ask him, what is this? What is this?
I think so.
Had a conversation.
Yeah. Cause this is one where he was pen and paper in the studio while we're listening, and he's, you know, moving words around and he's trying a few different things. And, I can't remember if he had the verse in place, the chorus. I think I must've asked him, or somebody was asking about the language on this tune. And that's what I got out of it, you know, was he was playing with these three different things.
Oh, that's just blown my mind. That makes so much sense. And I remember Tony saying that they were listening to Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly and D'Angelo's Black Messiah and The Time. So I guess that when you said, like, David trying to find an authentic way of accessing that way of performing and to quote that kind of style, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
Because Bowie never really did hip hop or rap or anything like that. He just never went near that form. He's picked up, absorbed so many forms over the years. I think the closest
Plastic Soul
was
we got the
Mickey
Plastic
Rourke.
Soul, didn't we?
We got that's true. We got Plastic Soul, but we didn't get any rap or hip hop.
Sorry, you just said Mickey Rourke, didn't
as Bowie.
You?
Sorry. Yes, exactly. On Never Let
New
Me
York's
Down.
In Love, is that right?
Yes, I think it's New
Sorry,
York's
that's
in
such
love.
A terrible rap. Anyway.
Let the heads out of shape in the name of Trotsky. Shouldn't frame Hitler cash down. No hope, the heroes cover this page with decks and heroin fingers of blood. Poor little bodies all covered in scabs. Threw it all away. Another life in the grave. Another life in the grave.
Life is like a broken arrow.
Well, Dollar Days, you know, we talked about this one last time where it was, we had kind of run out of things to record, and it was like, you know, 1:30 PM or something. And there was an acoustic guitar, and David just picked it up and started playing, and we were just watching him for a couple of minutes. And then it kind of became apparent that, you know, this was something. And I don't know if it was something he'd worked on before and just picked it, you know, or he just improvised. I'm not sure where it was at that point, but he's playing the acoustic guitar, and then, you know, maybe 20 minutes or so later, we're at the piano, and Jason is at the piano, and they're working on it. And then he's at the piano, we're kind of sussing it out, you know. Then Tim gets the bass, Mark gets on the drums. I remember making a suggestion about, you know, where to a modulation for the sax solo. And then just kind of happened. And it happened, you know, from the time he picks up the guitar until, you know, we start tracking, I'm going to say is like a half hour, 40 minutes. And then the whole thing's over an hour after that. And it happened so quickly that I had forgotten about it. And that then when I had done one of the preliminary interviews for Black Star, the journalist was asking me about the song, and I just had no idea what he was talking about. And it wasn't until I heard it, so this is one where the lyrics weren't really in place. He was humming the melody, but the lyrics on this one are really incredible, I have to say.
They really are, aren't they? I mean, it's such a heart. I mean, obviously, with hindsight, listening to these lyrics, listening to lines like "I'm dying to push their backs against the grain and fool them all again and again," you know, there's a sense of like, you know, I'm desperate to do this again, but then if I don't see the English evergreens again,
well, this was that
okay.
this was that song that, you know, once we woke up and we heard that he had passed, we all thought of, oh, I'm dying to, and then, you know, all the Enigma machine clicks into place, and you're like, oh, you know, this was the song that felt like it might have been a goodbye, or it might have been some kind of
definitely,
play on words
definitely.
That had a benefit at the end that he might have had in mind or something like that. So it's the one that was hard to listen to, obviously, in the aftermath.
there's some songs like Lazarus and Black Star, which are incredibly big, dramatic meditations on death and mortality in many ways. Then there's this, which is almost an internal tussle, like a internal debate as to how does one feel at a certain point towards the end of one's life.
When I got my hands on the chords and I worked it out and I was at the piano, and it's one of those ones that, you know, where Bowie writes a song and the harmony is like, wow, like what's going on here? There's this bit, you know, where it's all, you know, in G minor and it's all sort of curved and it's all, you know, lovely formed at the piano type songwriting. But then the chorus is all pinned down with these, like, you know, the bass is not the root of the chord. It's another note, which gives it this tension, and then a chord on top, which is dissonant. And it's this tension building, no resolution. And it keeps going and going. It never lets up until the very, very end of the song when it leads into the next one. And I just think, like, that's, to me, is like, that's a masterclass in songwriting. The guy knew what he was doing, you know. People tell me that, you know, Bowie's just a self-taught whatever, he doesn't know what he's doing. I'm like, no, you got to look at these things. Like, that's somebody who knows exactly what chords can do and how you can push the emotion of a song forward just by a few simple choices. It blew me away when I was playing through that. I was like, oh, yeah, so nice, so classy.
Okay, so now we come to, well, we come to the final track on the final album. Donnie, What are your memories of hearing this for the first time? How did this song first present itself to you?
I think the first memory is that I got this song, I think, the day before we went to record, or 2 days before. So I didn't have the usual lead time to sort of prepare and wrap my head around orchestration ideas. You know, as with so many of the other songs, I remember immediately really being drawn to it and felt that it was a really compelling song. And the lyrics in the demo were, the hook, I can't give you everything, was there. And the rest of the lyrics weren't in place yet. And it was kind of like he was singing the melody and making up words as he was singing, but it's not what's in place.
Okay, so the bare bones were in place, really.
The melody, the vocal melody is in place. He's making up lyrics except for the hook, which is there. And then, you know, the harmonica.
All right, yeah, sound. Yeah, that was the harmonica.
I don't know if that is a harmonica or just a synth sample, but that was there in the demo. And I think I mentioned that at some point we talked, but I just want to reiterate that. That was there. So as far as I know, that was David, either, you know, playing it or programming it. And the synths, the kind of those pads were there also. I think the sound from the demo to the final is different. And I don't know if that was Jason or Tony or David, you know, in post-production, I'm not sure. But and then there's that rhythmic figure that you guys hear, like, right, that's in there on his demo. Oh, yeah. And it's also a synth sound, but it's a different timbre than the pads. And so, as you probably already know this, but I heard that and thought, okay, that would sound cool, I think, on a bed of flutes. So I played that rhythmic figure on some sort of bed of flutes. And then the saxophones, I just played these big chords that, as I heard them going through the song, you know, it's not a lot of chords. And so I just, these kind of big beds of sound that I played. And so, that was, you know, that was kind of it. I think the form of the demo had space for solos. And I can't remember right now if it's exactly how we recorded it, as I think it was pretty similar, and that there was a space, and that's where the saxophone improvises. And then there's some more singing, and then there's a guitar solo. So I think we added that a bit once we got to recording it. So anyway, a lot of what you hear on the final is there in the demo, right? And it's just us playing it, you know. He had sequenced a drum beat, and
that's
it's similar.
It's a strange drum beat as well.
Well, yeah, and I think what happened, Leah, is that Mark played, of course, live, and we're tracking, and I think Tony, David, whoever made the decision, they looped, you know, a couple bars or a bar that he played. And then you hear that sound. It's pretty consistent throughout the track. I don't know how much it changes. I can't tell you off the top of my head, but I think that's what happened. Cause I don't think Mark played it quite. He was probably changing it up as we were playing to a certain extent. So,
it's a beautiful finale to the yes. album. And wow, that outro, what's going on there? It's a guitar solo.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Oh, at the guitar at the end. Ah, yeah. I need to listen to it again. I think it's Ben is soloing near the end, but I do something there. I have to listen to it again. But yeah, so, you know, this was recorded in that final week that we talked about, that week in March. And I mean, I just love the song. Similarly with other tunes, it was just a couple takes for the basic tracks, for bass and drums. And I remember I did a lot of the sax and flute stuff. That took some time, and it was a lot of huffing and puffing. if you know what I mean, I was like, you know, there's a lot of, you know. And it wasn't, because it doesn't move a lot. It was, you know, this kind of very wall of sound kind of thing. When it did get to soloing, I remember this is one where I wasn't totally taken with the solo that I did when we tracked it as a band. And so I did come back the next morning. I got to the studio a little bit early and I banged out a few solos. And this one, the one on the final track, was one of those. And I remember David coming in and me saying, "Hey, I think this is the one. What do you think? How does this strike you?" And he was very happy. This is one of the things that's still just so meaningful to me, you know, that not so much like, "Hey, didn't I sound great? What do you think?" You know, not that way, but just that, you know, he had entrusted us with these great songs. And then I talked about this before, I think just that look of happiness, yeah. You know, when it was there and I could give you, you know, but for, so that was a moment, you know, where he just felt, he felt so happy with how the solo had turned out. And it was so much, it was such an affirming moment for me, you know, as a musician and an artist. And I was just so happy, you know, that he felt that way. And then Ben, you know, Ben Maunder is very much a perfectionist, you know, and he also, I think, did some multiple solos. That's sort of what I remember of the recording. And then listening to it again, before I connected with you guys about a half hour ago, I love how there's a lot going on, but you hear everything and there's space and the synth, the pads, the string thing. I'm sure those are not real strings, but like a synth thing. And I'm pretty sure that's Tony and David, and it sounds great. It sounds great, man.
It's a suitably fitting performance. It's his swan song, isn't it? It's the lyrics seem to be an epitaph in the way to his career.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about the lyrics, you know, very powerful to say the least, you know.
Oh, I remember before he died and we heard this song and it was like, oh, this is like a, you know, a free form. It's just, you know, it's repetitive. It's these three chords that go over and over and he kind of builds and it's, you know, it's a bit unlike the other songs on the album. But then of course, after, you know, he died, man, we were all just in deep conversation about it. We were all pulling it apart. Like we were sort of saying, you know, the harmonica, is that a new career in a new town? Is it about frontiermanship and transition, or is it about, you know, Never Let Me Down, and is it about intimacy? And then I had a musicologist friend who I hadn't even talked to for years, like, phoned me up in the mid, like almost in the middle of the night, like about 11 p.m. saying, "Is that the same melody as Soul Love? Is this what's going on?" And like, you know, trying to piece it all together in a situation room, like, what does it mean? And I think it more than anything, it feels like a little wink, like a little, you know, taking the mask off and just revealing himself a little bit, because he doesn't really do that in his music very often. And it's this one rare moment where you feel like he kind of locks eyes with you, and it's kind of an acknowledgement of some kind, and also addressing, you know, the nature of the relationship that he's had with his listeners throughout his whole career. And he can't tell you everything. He's going to keep some secrets. That's the game. That's why we love him. There's mystery there. You know, if he told us everything, it wouldn't be as good. So, and it feels like, you know, even if he had more songs in him and he had a new album, I still feel like as a late period piece, it's so meaningful from him, you know, from David and his songwriting, because of that. that shared moment with his listeners that engage with him, you know. Such a special song.
Yeah, it reminds me, by the way, of that. Do you remember that that cryptic Instagram account that somehow appeared around the time of Black Star, or about the single release, I think about November, just before the album came out? And it, I can't remember now the details, but it seemed it was, I think it was called the Villa Vormen, wasn't it? And it seemed to eerily echo quite a lot of the images in the song Black Star, and people were wondering if it was in fact by Bowie. And, well, I didn't think that's such a far-fetched notion, given his love of jokes and teases.
It was when the Black Star video came out, but its origin, I mean, I've been through this. I've been poring over this. This is like old school Bowie myths. The account began before Black Star was released, and it was called Villa. It was called Villa of Ormond, and it had lots of imagery that was shared with, not necessarily the song, but it was the song, but also the video. And then it kind of felt like it was prophetic in a sense, because it kept posting things that were very death obsessed. And then, of course, he died. And so everyone was like, you know, it was great. It was very effective. It really spooked everybody. So, you know, fantastic.
So we obviously don't know if it was really him.
I mean, if he did, but I'd pay that. I mean, if I had a hat, I'd take it off, because that was brilliant.
So we obviously don't know if it was really him. But talking of I can't give everything away, but it really provokes more questions than answers.
The beautiful thing about it, though, is that it lingers. It stays just a bit longer. And it just stays there in this like atmosphere of just, it feels quite transcendent, because it's just repetitive and, as you said, kind of minimalist in the sense of its harmonic structure. It just kind of rolls around and around, but these solos dance on it and celebrate, and it just feels so affirming and wonderful. And it's such a great way to end an album. You know, you don't want it to end. And then it finally kind of does trail off, but it's still kind of unresolved, right? Because it doesn't end on the chord that you want it to. It's still unresolved, and it just sort of fades off, and you're just like, oh, listen to it again.
There's a cyclical thing about the chord progression that feels seamless.
Yeah.
There's motion, but it feels seamless, and it just kind of keeps cycling, but it, I don't get bored with it.
Yeah.
Even if I were just to, I think, sit and play those chords, there's something about the cycle that feels, it's the sense of optimism.
Yes.
In that song. Yeah. Even though, you know, it's, I mean, you know, I can't give everything away, but it's not, you know, there is a feeling of optimism in this song to me.
Yeah, yeah. And thank God for that. I mean, can you imagine if he ended with those lyrics, but like with something with the atmosphere of heat, and that was the last song we were left with? We'd all be just so bereft and feeling really dark about it. But there's just something, and it reminds me of that wonderful photo of him, you know, that was released on his birthday when he's wearing the suit outside Magic, and he's got that smile on his face. That to me feels like it's like, you know, coupled with this song. It's that feeling of triumph and a feeling of, you know, satisfaction and happiness. I just think it's so great. It's like a poetic touch, you know. I don't think that he necessarily, I mean, who knows what anyone thinks, you know, but I don't think it was necessarily in his mind, this is my last song, it has to be like this. But I'm so glad that it ended up being that way. You know, it's not too maudlin. It's not too melancholy. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And you have to smile when you hear it. You know, you can't be sad.
This makes me think of something of that, you know, I don't think he was somebody who, I think he was somebody who was very realistic about what he was dealing with. I don't know, matter of fact about the situation and, you know, staring at it straight ahead and continuing to create. You know, and I think we talked about this last time, though, but this was a period of tremendous creative output. And you know, again, you know, my perspective, I knew him for, let's say, about a year and a half, you know, so of course, I don't know him over the course of decades, but, you know, well, you know, he was still writing and, you know, No Plan, Lazarus the Musical, Black Star, we were going to record again in January. Like, it was still, everything was still moving ahead creatively. And despite him being realistic, I think, and very in the moment about what he was dealing with.
there's some, like, someone in an interview somewhere said that the day they were filming the Lazarus video was the day he received the news of the terminal diagnosis. Oh. Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
It was the director, Johannes von Renck, who said that in the 5 years documentary, and just how he worked through that day. But obviously that must have been an unthinkable experience. So, Donny, were you aware during the recordings just how he wants to work with these songs? Did you have an idea of how they would all be sequenced and, you know, in what order they would go in? Or after you completed all your work on the sessions, was that pretty much it?
Initially, he had talked about it only being a vinyl release.
Nice.
And yeah, and only using, only vinyl and only a certain amount of music. Well, of course, if you're dealing with vinyl, you know, you're dealing with 40 something minutes. But so I remember having that in my head, thinking like, this is going to be a tough choice, you know, to whittle this down to 6, 7, 8 tunes when there's, you know, a lot of strong material. And
was the album in shape by the time your work was done?
It was, yeah, I guess along the way, you know, I'm trying to recall exactly how it went down, but we would talk about, you know, oh, this single, or this could be this, or there was a little bit of that, but in the abstract, you know, it was never like, oh, what do you think is going to be like the first tune on the record? Or, you know, there was none of that. So I, you know, on my side, I said, you know, I wasn't really concerned about that. I just wanted to, you know, get the music in the best place possible and just be totally present with that. So, and it, you know, I just, obviously it's his decision. So I just was wondering, how is this going to play out and what will he choose? And so when I heard it for the first time, you know, I was like, wow, okay. I was surprised by certain things, and yeah.
Okay, so you didn't actually know the final running order till you actually saw the finished album, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I had no idea Black Star was going to be first. And there was a couple of things that weren't on the record that I thought would make the record.
Like Blaze, but, you know, right? That
track. Which one is Blaze?
It's this mythical one Tony played it to me one time in the studio,
really?
And it sounded finished. Okay. Sounded really good.
Okay. Ooh, that piques my curiosity because I don't know. I don't remember that title, but I do remember a song that I really liked that hasn't come out. You know, it wasn't on No Plan and whatnot. And I wondered what happened to it, but I don't know what state it ended up in, so maybe that's the song.
Oh man, he played it in Visconti studio to a bunch of us, and I just remember freaking out and like thinking I need to remember details, and I was so freaked out I can't remember much about it, except that it's just really kind of like I was just like vibrating with anxiety, just thinking, what am I going to do? I need to capture this somehow. And of course, don't remember much, but it was really like upbeat. It was big. There was a lot going on. It was a real big arrangement. And I just thought, this sounds good to go. What are they doing? Like, you know, but.
That could be, you know, the song I thought of. Yeah. It'll be interesting. It would be great.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe one day.
Yeah.
Do you remember your last conversations with him? I mean, after the recording was done of Black Star, what was there more on the horizon? Was there talk of more work together between you?
Oh no, it was basically it was a phone conversation, and he mentioned, I'm working on some new music. I like to, you know, record if I'm you know, feeling better, you know, something. I made an allusion to his health situation, you know, if I'm able, do some recording in January. You know, I'm working on music when I can. So that was it, really. So I never heard any demos or anything. I don't know what he was working on, but it sounded, of course, like he wanted to continue what we had done, which would, of course, have been an amazing. And I think I told you guys the story of that I had my debut week at the Village Vanguard in New York was in January, and we had talked about him coming down and singing live with us, you know, which would have been incredible. So it would have been unbelievable. I can't imagine it. I think it just would have been just insane. We were going to do Tis a Pity and Lazarus.
Wow.
But of course, you know, but it would have been such a beautiful thing for him as somebody who had such a deep love for jazz music and creative music, and for him to sing in that space, which is like the Mecca, you know, of the jazz world. And for him to be on that stage, you know, it would have been incredible.
Your involvement and your band's involvement really elevates it. I mean, I love all of David's albums, but there's something, we talked about this before, there's some liveness, there's some blood flowing in this one, and it feels different, and it feels urgent, and it's just really special. I think Bowie fans do this a lot. What's your favorite album? It's number one for me. It's my favorite of all of his albums for that reason.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just think it's wonderful. And yeah, and what you guys did in supplying that energy and that lifeblood and that just that totally fresh sound, you know, you did that thing that Bowie loves to do, which is freshen up his sound and change his aesthetic, and you provided that.
Thank you.
You know, where I feel like before that he was a little bit stuck with his reality band, and it felt a little bit kind of bogged down, you know, and I think your band and your musicality was what he needed, I think.
Yeah, it's just really amazing to hear you talk about this whole experience you had in the studio, and not only just working with Bowie, what he was like as a person, but that dynamic between you, and how that dynamic, by fate or by stars aligning in the right place, it just turned into an absolutely perfect final result.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it was just a combination of everybody, you know, and I think we talked about it at the beginning when we started talking, you know, the framework of these songs were so powerful. And you know, actually, I can't give you everything. I can't give you everything as a good example of that, you know, because all these elements that you hear on the final were there in the demo. You know, the thing that ends up being a flute line, the bed of sounds, you know, this drum beat that's really consistent. You know, the solos weren't there, but like the harmonica, like, you know, it was, he provided this just incredible framework. And then we were, you know, ready to jump in and do our thing within that. And it was just a great, environment. And as I think I was telling you guys the other day, I couldn't have asked for a better environment. And in fact, you know, and he articulated that, you know, do whatever you want, whatever you're hearing, I'm totally game for it. Don't worry about what it's going to be called, blah, blah, blah. Just go. And it's, you can't ask for more than that. And so it just was such, you know, one of the most special things I've been involved with in my life for all those reasons, you know, it's just tremendous.
And that was Donny McCaslin, Leah Cardos, and myself, Arslan Mohammed, rounding off what's been a truly amazing experience for me, the inside story of Black Star. As ever, my thanks to them both for their time and their insights, and to you for listening to this podcast and for being so patient with me in my slow uploading of them. I've got some more tasty treats coming your way very soon, so please do keep an ear open for our next episode with a new guest who will be very familiar indeed to all inhabitants of Planet Bowie. But till then, please do like, rate, review, share this podcast. Get in touch if you've got any comments, and I will be back hopefully very soon indeed. So yeah, enjoy the summer, and wherever you are, whatever you're doing, we're here for you. Take care. Bye bye.